He made good on his threat and doubled the number of men working on the building. They worked at night, in rain, in stifling heat. In August alone, the building took 3 lives. Elsewhere on the grounds, 4 other men died, and dozens more suffered all manner of fractures, burns, and lacerations. The fair, according to one later appraisal, was a more dangerous place to work than a coal mine. Burnham intensified his drive for more power. The constant clash between the Exposition Company and the National Commission had become nearly unbearable. Even the congressional investigators had recognized that the overlapping jurisdiction was a source of discord and needless expense. Their report recommended that Davis's salary be cut in half, a clear sign that the balance of power had shifted. The company and commission worked out a truce. On August 24th, the executive committee named Burnham director of works, chief of everything. Soon afterward, Burnham dispatched letters to all his department heads, including Olmsted. I have assumed personal control of the active work within the grounds of the World's Columbian Exposition, he wrote. Henceforward, and until further notice, you will report to and receive orders from me exclusively. In Pittsburgh, the young steel engineer became more convinced than ever that his challenge to the Eiffel Tower could succeed. He asked a partner in his inspection firm, W.F. Granau, to calculate the novel forces that would play among the components of his structure. In engineering parlance, it embodied little dead load, the static weight of immobile masses of brick and steel. Nearly all of it was live load, meaning weight that changes over time, as when a train passes over a bridge. I had no precedent, Granau said. After 3 weeks of intense work, however, he came up with detailed specifications. The numbers were persuasive, even to Burnham. In June, the Ways and Means Committee agreed that the thing should be built. They granted a concession. The next day, the committee revoked it. Second thoughts, after a night spent dreaming of freak winds and shrieking steel, and 2,000 lives gone in a wink. One member of the committee now called it a monstrosity. A chorus of engineers chanted the thing could not be built, at least not with any margin of safety. Its young designer still did not concede defeat, however. He spent $25,000 on drawings and additional specifications and used these to recruit a cadre of investors that included 2 prominent engineers, Robert Hunt, head of a major Chicago firm, and Andrew Onderdonk, famous for helping construct the Canadian Pacific Railway. Soon, he sensed a change. The new man in charge of the Midway, Saul Bloom, had struck like a bolt of lightning and seemed amenable to just about anything. The more novel and startling, the better. And Burnham had gained almost limitless power over the construction and operation of the fair. The engineer readied himself for a third try. In the first week of September 1892, Olmsted and his young party left England for home, departing Liverpool aboard the City of New York. The seas were high, the crossing difficult. Seasickness felled Marion and left Rick perpetually queasy. Olmsted's own health again declined. His insomnia came back. He wrote, "I was more disabled when I returned than when I left." Now, however, he had no time to recuperate. Dedication Day was only a month away, and Harry Codman was again ill, incapacitated by the same stomach problem that had struck him during the summer. Olmsted left for Chicago to take over direct supervision of the work while Codman recovered. "I am still tortured a good deal with neuralgia and toothache," Olmsted wrote, "and I am tired and have a growing dread of worry and anxiety." In Chicago, he found a changed park. The mines building was done, as was the fisheries building. Most of the other buildings were well underway, including, incredibly, the giant manufacturer's building, where hundreds of workers swarmed its scaffolds and roof. The building's floor alone had consumed 5 train car loads of nails. Amid all this work, however, the landscape had suffered. Temporary tracks latticed the grounds. Wagons had gouged chasms across paths, roads, and would-be lawns. Litter lay everywhere. A first-time visitor might wonder if Olmsted's men had done any work at all. Olmsted, of course, knew that tremendous progress had been made, but it was the sort that escaped casual notice. Lagoons existed now where once there had been barren land. The elevated sites upon which the building stood had not existed until his grading teams created them. The previous spring his men had planted nearly everything raised in the exposition's nurseries, plus an additional 200,000 trees, aquatic plants and ferns, and 30,000 more willow cuttings. All this under the direction of his aptly named head gardener, E. Den. In the time left before dedication day, Burnham wanted Olmsted's men to concentrate on cleaning the grounds and dressing them with flowers and temporary lawns of sod, actions that Olmsted understood were necessary, but that clashed with his career-long emphasis on designing for scenic effects that might not be achieved for decades. "Of course, the main work suffers," he wrote. One indisputably positive development had occurred during his absence, however. Burnham had awarded the boat concession to a company called the Electric Launch and Navigation Company, which had produced a lovely electric vessel of exactly the character Olmsted wanted. On dedication day, even the press was polite enough to overlook the stark appearance of the grounds and the unfinished feel of the manufacturer's building. To have done otherwise would have been an act of disloyalty to Chicago and the nation. The dedication had been anticipated nationwide. Francis J. Bellamy, an editor of Youth's Companion, thought it would be a fine thing if on that day all the school children of America, in unison, offered something to their nation. He composed a pledge which the Bureau of Education mailed to virtually every school. It began, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." A great parade brought Burnham and other dignitaries to the manufacturer's building, where a standing army of 140,000 Chicagoans filled the 32-acre floor. Shafts of sunlight struck through the rising mist of human breath. 5,000 yellow chairs stood on the red-carpeted speaker's platform, and in these chairs sat businessmen dressed in black, foreign commissioners and clerics in scarlet, purple, green, and gold. Ex-Mayor Carter Harrison, running now for a 5th term, strode about shaking hands, his black slouch hat raising cheers from supporters in the crowd. At the opposite end of the building was a 5,000-voice choir, which sang Handel's Hallelujah Chorus to the accompaniment of 500 musicians. At one point, a spectator recalled, 90,000 people suddenly rose and stood upon their feet and simultaneously waved and fluttered 90,000 snowy pocket handkerchiefs. The air was cut into dusty spirals which vibrated to the great iron-ribbed ceiling. One had a sense of dizziness, as if the entire building rocked. The chamber was so immense that visual signals had to be used to let the chorus know when a speaker had stopped talking and a new song could begin. Microphones did not yet exist, so only a small portion of the audience actually heard any speeches. The rest, with faces contorted from the strain of trying to listen, saw large, distant men gesturing wildly into the sound-killing miasma of whispers, coughs, and creaking shoe leather. Harriet Monroe, the poet who had been John Root's sister-in-law, was there and watched as two of the nation's greatest speakers, Colonel Henry Watterson of Kentucky and Chauncey M. Depew of New York, took turns at the podium, both orators waving their windy words toward a vast, whispering, rustling audience which could not hear. This was a big day for Miss Monroe. She had composed a lengthy poem for the event, her Columbian ode and pestered her many powerful friends into having it placed on the day's program. She watched with pride as an actress read it to the few thousand people close enough to hear it. Unlike the majority of the audience, Monroe believed the poem to be rather a brilliant work, so much so that she had hired a printer to produce 5,000 copies for sale to the public. She sold few, and attributed the debacle to America's fading love of poetry. That winter, she burned the excess copies for fuel. Prendergast. On November 28, 1892, Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast, the mad Irish immigrant, selected one of his postal cards. He was 24 years old now, and despite his accelerating mental decline, was still employed by the Interocean as a delivery contractor. The card, like all the others, was 4 inches wide by 5 inches long, blank on one face, with postal insignia and a printed 1 cent stamp on the other. In this time when writing long letters was everyday practice, men of normal sensibility saw these cards as the most crabbed of media, little better than telegrams, but to Prendergast, this square of stiff paper was a vehicle that gave him voice in the skyscrapers and mansions of the city. He addressed this particular card to A.S. Trude, lawyer. He sketched the letters of the name in large floral script, as if seeking to dispatch the cumbersome duty of addressing the card as quickly as possible before advancing to the message itself. That Prendergast selected Trude to be one of his correspondents was not surprising. Prendergast read widely and possessed a good grasp of the grip car wrecks, murders, and city hall machinations covered so fervently by the city's newspapers. He knew that Alfred S. Trude was one of Chicago's best criminal defense attorneys, and that from time to time he was hired by the state to serve as prosecutor, a practice customary in particularly important cases. Prendergast filled the postcard from top margin to bottom, from edge to edge, with little regard for whether the sentences formed level lines or not. He gripped the pen so tightly it impressed channels into the tips of his thumb and forefinger. "My dear Mr. Trude," he began, "were you much hurt?" An accident reported in the press had caused Trude minor injuries. "Your humble servant hereby begs leave to tender you his sincere sympathy, and trusts that while he does not appear before you in person, you nonetheless will not have any doubts as to his real sympathy for you in your misfortunes. You are wished by him a speedy recovery from the results of the accident which you had the misfortune to meet with." He wrote with a tone of familiarity that presumed Trude would consider him a peer. As the note progressed, his handwriting shrank until it seemed like something extruded rather than written. "I suppose, Mr. Trude, that you do understand that the greatest authority on the subject of law is Jesus Christ, and that you also know that the fulfillment of the whole law depends upon the observance of these two commands, thou shalt love God most of all, and your neighbor as yourself. These are the greatest commands, if you please, sir." The note clicked from theme to theme like the wheels of a train crossing a freight yard. Have you ever saw the picture of the fat man who looked for his dog while his dog was at his feet and still did not have the wit to see what was the matter? Have you observed the cat? He did not add a closing and did not sign the note. He simply ran out of room, then posted the card. Trude read the note and at first dismissed it as the work of a crank. The number of troubled men and women seemed to be increasing with each passing year. The jails were full of them, a warden later would testify. Inevitably, some became dangerous, like Charles Guiteau, the man who assassinated President Garfield in Washington. For no clear reason, Trude kept the card. "I want you at once." In late November, the young Pittsburgh engineer once again put his proposal for out-Eiffeling Eiffel before the Ways and Means Committee. This time, in addition to drawings and specifications, he included a list of investors, the names of the prominent men on his board, and proof that he had raised enough money to finance the project to completion. On December 16, 1892, the committee granted him a concession to build his structure in the Midway Plaisance. This time, the decision held. He needed an engineer willing to go to Chicago and supervise the construction effort, and thought he knew just the man. Luther V. Rice, assistant engineer of the Union Depot and Tunnel Company, St. Louis. His letter to Rice began, "I have on hand a great project for the World's Fair in Chicago. I am going to build a vertically revolving wheel 250 feet in diameter." Nowhere in this letter, however, did he reveal the true dimension of his vision, that this wheel would carry 36 cars, each the size of a Pullman, each holding 60 people and equipped with its own lunch counter, and how, when filled to capacity, the wheel would propel 2,160 people at a time, 300 feet into the sky over Jackson Park, a bit higher than the crown of the now 6-year-old Statue of Liberty. He told Rice, "I want you at once, if you can come." He signed the letter, George Washington Gale Ferris. Chapel Redux. One day in the first week of December 1892, Emmeline Sigrund set out for Holmes's building in Inglewood bearing a small, neatly wrapped parcel. Initially, her mood was bright, for the parcel contained an early Christmas present she planned to give to her friends, the Lawrences. But as she neared the corner of 63rd and Wallace, her spirits dimmed. Where once the building had seemed almost a palace, not for its architectural nobility, but for what it promised, now it looked drab and worn. She climbed the stairs to the second floor and went directly to the Lawrences' apartment. The warmth and welcome resurrected her good spirits. She handed the parcel to Mrs. Lawrence, who opened it immediately and pulled from the wrapping a tin plate upon which Emmeline had painted a lovely forest. The gift delighted Mrs. Lawrence, but also perplexed her. Christmas was only 3 weeks off, she said, kindly. Why hadn't Emmeline simply waited and given the plate then, when Mrs. Lawrence could have offered a gift in return? Her face brightening, Emmeline explained that she was going home to Indiana to spend Christmas with her family. She seemed delighted with the anticipation of a visit to them, Mrs. Lawrence said. She spoke in most affectionate terms of them and seemed as happy as a child. But Mrs. Lawrence also sensed a note of finality in Emmeline's voice that suggested Emmeline's journey might have another purpose. She said, "You are not going away from us." "Well," Emmeline said, "I don't know. Maybe." Mrs. Lawrence laughed. "Why, Mr. Holmes could never get along without you." Emmeline's expression changed. He could if he had to. The remark confirmed something for the Lawrences. It had seemed to me for some time that Miss Sigrund was changing in her feelings toward Holmes, said Dr. Lawrence. In the light of what has happened since, I believe now that she had found out, to a certain extent, the real character of Holmes and determined to leave him. She may have begun to believe the stories she heard in the neighborhood of Holmes's penchant for acquiring things on credit and then not paying for them. Stories she had heard all along, for they were rife, but that she at first dismissed as the gossip of envious hearts. Later there was speculation that Emmeline herself had trusted Holmes with her $800 savings, only to have it disappear in a fog of promises and lavish future returns. Ned Connor's warning echoed in her mind. Lately she had begun talking of returning one day to Dwight to resume her work for Dr. Keeley. Emmeline never told the Lawrences goodbye. Her visits simply stopped. That she would leave without a parting word struck Mrs. Lawrence as being very much out of character. She wasn't sure whether to feel wounded or worried. She asked Holmes what he knew about Emmeline's absence. Ordinarily, Holmes looked at Mrs. Lawrence with a directness that was unsettling, but now he avoided her gaze. "Oh, she's gone away to get married," Holmes said, as if nothing could have interested him less. The news shocked Mrs. Lawrence. "I don't see why she didn't mention something to me about getting married." "It was a secret," Holmes explained. Emmeline and her betrothed had revealed their wedding plans only to him. But for Mrs. Lawrence, this explanation only raised more questions. Why would the couple want such privacy? Why had Emmeline said nothing to Mrs. Lawrence when together they had shared so many other confidences? Mrs. Lawrence missed Emmeline and the way her effervescence and physical brightness, her prettiness and sunflower hair, lit the sullen halls of Holmes's building. She remained perplexed and a few days later again asked Holmes about Emmeline. He pulled a square envelope from his pocket. "This will tell you," he said. The envelope contained a wedding announcement, not engraved as was customary, merely typeset. This too surprised Mrs. Lawrence. Emmeline never would have accepted so mundane a means of communicating news of such magnitude. The announcement read, "Mr. Robert E. Phelps, Miss Emmeline C. Sigrund, married, Wednesday, December 7th, 1892, Chicago." Holmes told Mrs. Lawrence he had received his copy from Emmeline herself. "Some days after going away, she returned for her mail," he explained in his memoir, "and at this time gave me one of her wedding cards and also two or three others for tenants in the building who were not then in their rooms. And in response to inquiries lately made, I have learned that at least five persons in and about Lafayette, Indiana, received such cards. The postmark and her handwriting upon the envelope in which they were enclosed, showing that she must have sent them herself after leaving my employ." Emmeline's family and friends did receive copies of the announcement through the mail, and indeed these appeared to have been addressed by Emmeline herself. Most likely Holmes forged the envelopes or else duped Emmeline into preparing them by persuading her they would be used for a legitimate purpose, perhaps for Christmas cards. For Mrs. Lawrence, the announcement explained nothing. Emmeline had never mentioned a Robert Phelps, and if Emmeline had come to the building bearing marriage announcements, she surely would have presented one in person. The next day, Mrs. Lawrence stopped Holmes yet again, and this time asked what he knew about Phelps. In the same dismissive manner, Holmes said, "Oh, he is a fellow Miss Sigrund met somewhere. I do not know anything about him except that he is a traveling man." News of Emmeline's marriage reached her hometown newspaper, which reported it on December 8, 1892, in a small, chatty bulletin. The item called Emmeline a lady of refinement who possesses a character that is strong and pure. Her many friends feel that she has exercised good judgment in selecting a husband and will heartily congratulate her. The item offered a few biographical details, among them the fact that Emmeline once had been employed as a stenographer in the county recorder's office. From there, the item continued, she went to Dwight, and from there to Chicago, where she met her fate. Fate being the writer's coy allusion to marriage. In the days that followed, Mrs. Lawrence asked Holmes additional questions about Emmeline, but he responded only in monosyllables. She began to think of Emmeline's departure as a disappearance and recalled that soon after Emmeline's last visit, a curious change in routine had occurred within Holmes's building. The day after Miss Sigrun disappeared, or the day we last saw her, the door of Holmes's office was kept locked and nobody went into it except Holmes and Patrick Quinlan, Mrs. Lawrence said. About 7 o'clock in the evening, Holmes came out of his office and asked two men who were living in the building if they would not help him carry a trunk downstairs. The trunk was new and large, about 4 feet long. Its contents clearly were heavy and made the big trunk difficult to manage. Holmes repeatedly cautioned his helpers to be careful with it. An express wagon arrived and took it away. Mrs. Lawrence later claimed that at this point she became convinced Holmes had killed Emmeline. Yet she and her husband made no effort to move from the building, nor did they go to the police. No one did. Not Mrs. Lawrence, not Mr. and Mrs. Peter Sigrund, not Ned Connor, and not Julia's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Smythe. It was as if no one expected the police would be interested in yet another disappearance, or if they were, that they would be competent enough to conduct an effective investigation. Soon afterward, Emmeline's own trunk filled with her belongings and all the clothing she had brought with her when she left home in 1891 to work for Keeley arrived at a freight depot near her hometown. Her parents at first believed, hoped, she had sent the trunk home because now that she was marrying a wealthy man, she no longer needed such old and worn things. The Sigrunds received no further mail from Emmeline, not even at Christmas. "This," said Dr. B.J. Sigrund, Emmeline's second cousin, the North Side dentist, "in spite of the fact that she was in the habit of writing to her parents 2 or 3 times a week. Emmeline's parents still did not imagine murder, however. Peter Sigrund said, "I had at last come to the belief she must have died in Europe, and her husband either did not know our address or neglected to notify us." The Sigrunds and Lawrences would have found their anxiety intensified many-fold had they known a few other facts. That the name Phelps was an alias that Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pittitzel, had used when he first met Emmeline at the Keeley Institute. That on January 2, 1893, Holmes again had enlisted the help of Charles Chappell, the articulator, and sent him a trunk containing the corpse of a woman, her upper body stripped nearly bare of flesh. That a few weeks later, the LaSalle Medical School of Chicago had taken delivery of a nicely articulated skeleton. And that something peculiar had occurred in the room-sized vault in Holmes's building, a phenomenon that, when finally discovered by police 3 years later, would defy scientific explanation. Somehow, a footprint had become etched into the smooth enameled finish on the inside of the vault door at a point roughly 2 feet above the floor. The toes, the ball, and the heel were so clearly outlined as to leave no doubt that a woman had left the print. The degree of detail mystified the police, as did the print's resilience. They tried rubbing it off by hand, then with a cloth and soap and water, but it remained as clear as ever. No one could explain it with any certainty. The best guess posited that Holmes had lured a woman into the vault, that the woman was shoeless at the time, perhaps nude, and that Holmes had then closed the airtight door to lock her inside. She had left the print in a last, hopeless effort to force the door open. To explain the print's permanence, detectives theorized that Holmes, known to have an avid interest in chemistry, first poured a sheen of acid onto the floor to hasten, by chemical reaction, the consumption of oxygen in the vault. The theory held that Emmeline had stepped in the acid, then placed her feet against the door, thus literally etching the print into the enamel. This revelation, of course, came much later. As of the start of 1893, the year of the fair, no one, including Holmes, had noticed the footprint on the door. The cold-blooded fact. At the start of January 1893, the weather turned cold and stayed cold, the temperature falling to 20 degrees below zero. In his dawn tours, Burnham faced a hard, pale world. Cairns of frozen horse manure punctuated the landscape. Along the banks of the wooded island, ice 2 feet thick locked Olmsted's bulrush and sedge in cruel contortions. Burnham saw that Olmsted's work was far behind. And now Olmsted's man in Chicago, Harry Codman, upon whom everyone had come to depend, was in the hospital recovering from surgery. His recurring illness had turned out to be appendicitis. The operation under ether had gone well and Codman was recuperating, but his recovery would be slow. Only 4 months remained until opening day. The extreme cold increased the threat of fire. The necessary fires alone, the salamanders and tinner's pots, had caused dozens of small blazes, easily put out, but the cold increased the likelihood of far worse. It froze water lines and hydrants, and drove workers to break Burnham's ban on smoking and open flame. The men of the Columbian Guard stepped up their vigilance. It was they who suffered most from the cold, standing watch around the clock in far-flung reaches of the park where no shelter existed. The winter of 1892 to 1893 will always be remembered by those who served on the guard during that period, wrote Colonel Rice, their commander. Its members most dreaded being assigned to an especially bleak sector at the extreme south end of the park below the agriculture building. They called it Siberia. Colonel Rice used their dread to his advantage. Any guard ordered to the post along the south fence would realize that he had been guilty of some minor breach of discipline, or that his personal appearance rendered him too unsightly for the more public parts of the grounds. The demands on Burnham multiplied with each new day. Most nights he got only 5 hours of sleep, sometimes only three. He wrote to his family but did not see them. He looked forward to the closing hours of each night when he and his associates would gather before the shanty hearth with cigars and Madeira, the group endlessly buoyed by Frank Millett's bawdy good humor. Charles McKim wrote to Millett, "If you find time to get to bed some night before 2 o'clock, just remember that there are several of your friends who haven't seen you who would like to have the opportunity of a little talk when you have a moment to spare." Burnham constantly patrolled the grounds with a retinue of architects, engineers, and supervisors. "The director of works seemed omnipresent," said one senior executive of the exposition company. "No hour was too early, no weather too severe for him to be abroad, inspecting and directing the progress of the work and urging on his lieutenants." Dedication Day had gone well, but Burnham could sense the charity and the glowing appraisals of friends. The real test was opening day. There would be less charity, greater expectation. More progress had to be made, and faster. Thankfully, Harry Codman seemed to be recovering nicely. At night, as the ice deepened and settled, pistol-shot fractures raced across the lagoon. On the lake, nothing moved. The darkness was absolute. George Ferris fought the cold with dynamite, the only efficient way to penetrate the 3-foot crust of frozen earth that now covered Jackson Park. Once opened, the ground still posed problems. Just beneath the crust lay a 20-foot stratum of the same quicksand Chicago builders always confronted, only now it was ice-cold and a torment for workers. The men used jets of live steam to thaw dirt and prevent newly poured cement from freezing. They drove timber piles to hardpan 32 feet underground. On top of these, they laid a grillage of steel, then filled it with cement. To keep the excavated chambers as dry as possible, they ran pumps 24 hours a day. They repeated the process for each of the 8 140-foot towers that would support the Ferris wheel's giant axle. At first, Ferris's main worry was whether he could acquire enough steel to build his machine. He realized, however, that he had an advantage over anyone else trying to place a new order. Through his steel inspection company, he knew most of the nation's steel executives and the products they made. He was able to pull in favors and spread his orders among many different companies. No one shop could begin to do all the work, Therefore, contracts were let to a dozen different firms, each being chosen because of some peculiar fitness for the work entrusted to it, according to an account by Ferris's company. Ferris also commanded a legion of inspectors who evaluated the quality of each component as it emerged from each mill. This proved to be a vital benefit since the wheel was a complex assemblage of 100,000 parts that ranged in size from small bolts to the giant axle, which at the time of its manufacture by Bethlehem Steel was the largest one-piece casting ever made. Absolute precision was necessary, as few of the parts could be put together until they were upon the ground, and an error of the smallest fraction of an inch might be fatal. The wheel Ferris envisioned actually consisted of two wheels, spaced 30 feet apart on the axle. What had frightened Burnham at first was the apparent insubstantiality of the design. Each wheel was essentially a gigantic bicycle wheel. Slender iron rods just 2.5 inches thick and 80 feet long linked the rim, or felloe, of each wheel to a spider affixed to the axle. Struts and diagonal rods ran between the two wheels to stiffen the assembly and give it the strength of a railroad bridge. A chain weighing 20,000 pounds connected a sprocket on the axle to sprockets driven by twin 1,000-horsepower steam engines. For aesthetic reasons, the boilers were to be located 700 feet outside the midway, the steam shunted to the engines through 10-inch underground pipes. This, at least, is how it looked on paper. Just digging and installing the foundation, however, had proven more difficult than Ferris and Rice had expected, and they knew that far greater hurdles lay ahead. Foremost among them, the challenge of raising that huge axle to its mount atop the 8 towers. Together with its fittings, the axle weighed 142,031 pounds. Nothing that heavy had been lifted before, let alone to such a height. Olmsted, in Brookline, got the news by telegram. Harry Codman was dead. Codman, his protege, whom he loved like a son. He was 29. "You will have heard of our great calamity," Olmsted wrote to his friend Gifford Pinchot. "As yet I am as one standing on a wreck and can hardly see when we shall be afloat again." Olmsted's son, John, wrote to Burnham, "I know that I do not realize yet the loss, as I am sure to do as time goes on. He has been like a brother to me these 10 years, and like a son to my father." Phil Codman, Harry's brother, wrote, "We can hardly yet realize that he is gone." Olmsted recognized that now he himself would have to take over direct supervision of the exposition work, but he felt less up to the duty than ever. He and Phil arrived in Chicago at the beginning of February to find the city locked in brutal cold, the temperature 8 degrees below zero. On February 4th, he sat down at Codman's desk for the first time and found it awash with stacks of invoices and memoranda. Olmsted's head raged with noise and pain. He had a sore throat. He was deeply sad. The task of sorting through Codman's accumulated papers and of taking over the exposition work now seemed beyond him. He asked a former assistant, Charles Elliott, now one of Boston's best landscape architects, if he would come to help. After some hesitation, Elliott agreed. On arrival, Elliott saw immediately that Olmsted was ill. By the evening of February 17, 1893, as a blizzard bore down on Chicago, Olmsted was under a doctor's care, confined to his hotel. The same night, Olmsted wrote to John in Brookline. Weariness and sorrow freighted each page of his letter. "It looks as if the time has come when it is necessary for you to count me out," he wrote. The work in Chicago had begun to look hopeless. "It is very plain that as things are, we are not going to be able to do our duty here." By early March, Olmsted and Elliot were back in Brookline. Elliot, now a full-fledged partner. The firm newly renamed Olmsted, Olmsted and Elliot. The exposition work was still far behind schedule and a major source of worry, but Olmsted's health and the pressure of other work had forced him from Chicago. With deep misgivings, Olmsted had left the work in the care of his superintendent, Rudolf Ulrich, whom he had come to distrust. On March 11th, Olmsted dispatched a long letter to Ulrich full of instructions. "I have never before, in all the numerous works for which I have been broadly responsible, trusted as much to the discretion of an assistant or co-operator," Olmsted wrote. "And the results have been such that in the straits in which we are placed by the death of Mr. Codman and my ill health, and the consequent excessive pressure of other duties, I am more than ever disposed to pursue this policy and to carry it further. But I must confess that I cannot do so without much anxiety." He made it clear that this anxiety was due to Ulrich, specifically Ulrich's constitutional propensity to lose sight of the broad scheme and throw himself into minute tasks better handled by subordinates, a trait that Olmsted feared had left Ulrich vulnerable to demands by other officials, in particular Burnham. "Never lose sight of the fact that our special responsibility as landscape artists applies primarily to the broad, comprehensive scenery of the exposition," Olmsted wrote. The underlining was his. "This duty is not to make a garden or to produce garden effects, but relates to the scenery of the exposition as a whole, first of all and most essentially the scenery, in a broad and comprehensive way. If, for lack of time and means, or of good weather, we come short in matters of detailed decoration, our failure will be excusable. If we fall short in matters affecting broad landscape effects, we shall fail in our primary and essential duty." He went on to identify for Ulrich the things that most worried him about the fair, among them the color scheme chosen by Burnham and the architects. "Let me remind you that the whole field of the exposition has already come to be popularly called the White City. I fear that against the clear blue sky and the blue lake, great towering masses of white, glistening in the clear, hot summer sunlight of Chicago, with the glare of the water that we are to have both within and without the exposition grounds, will be overpowering." This, he wrote, made it more important than ever to provide a counterbalance of dense, broad, luxuriant green bodies of foliage. Clearly the possibility of failure at the exposition had occurred to Olmsted and troubled him. Time was short, the weather terrible. The spring planting season would be brief. Olmsted had begun to think in terms of fallback arrangements. He warned Ulrich, "Do not lay out to do anything in the way of decorative planting that you shall not be quite certain that you will have ample time and means to perfect of its kind. There can be little fault found with simple, neat turf. Do not be afraid of plain, undecorated, smooth surfaces." It was far better, Olmsted lectured, to under-decorate than to over-decorate. "Let us be thought overmuch plain and simple, even bare, rather than gaudy, flashy, cheap, and meretricious. Let us manifest the taste of gentlemen." Snow fell. Bales of it. It fell day after day until hundreds of tons of it lay upon the rooftops at Jackson Park. The exposition was to be a warm weather affair, set to run from May through October. No one had thought to design the roofs to resist such extreme loading from snow. Men working at the manufacturer's building heard the shriek of failed steel and ran for cover. In a great blur of snow and silvery glass, the building's roof, that marvel of late 19th century hubris, enclosing the greatest volume of unobstructed space in history, collapsed to the floor below. Soon afterwards, a reporter from San Francisco made his way to Jackson Park. He had come prepared to admire the grand achievement of Burnham's army of workers, but instead found himself troubled by what he saw in the stark, frozen landscape. "This seems to be an impossibility," he wrote. "To be sure, those in charge claim that they will be ready on time. Still, the cold-blooded fact stares one in the face that only the woman's building is anywhere near completion inside and out." Yet the fair was to open in little more than 2 months. Acquiring Minnie. For Holmes, despite the persistent deep cold of the first 2 months of 1893, things never looked better. With Emmeline gone and neatly disposed of, he now was able to concentrate on his growing web of enterprise. He savored its scope. He owned a portion of a legitimate company that produced a machine for duplicating documents. He sold mail-order ointments and elixirs, and by now had established his own alcohol treatment company, the Silver Ash Institute, his answer to Keeley's gold cure. He collected rents from the Lawrences and his other tenants, and owned two houses, one on Honoré Street, the other the new house in Wilmette, now occupied by his wife Murda and daughter Lucy, which he himself had designed and then built with the help of as many as 75 largely unpaid workers. And soon he would begin receiving his first World's Fair guests. He spent much of his time outfitting his hotel. He acquired high-grade furnishings from the Toby Furniture Company, and crystal and ceramics from the French Potter Crockery Company, and did so without paying a dime, though he recognized that soon the companies would attempt to collect on the promissory notes he had given them. This did not worry him. He had learned through experience that delay and heartfelt remorse were powerful tools with which he could fend off creditors, for months and years, sometimes forever. Such prolonged standoffs would not be necessary, however, for he sensed that his time in Chicago was nearing an end. Mrs. Lawrence's questioning had become more pointed, almost accusing, and lately some of his creditors had begun exhibiting an extraordinary hardening of resolve. One firm, Merchant and Company, which had supplied the iron for his kiln and vault, had gone so far as to secure a writ of replevin to take the iron back. In an inspection of the building, however, its agents had been unable to find anything they could identify conclusively as a merchant product. Far more annoying were the letters from parents of missing daughters and the private detectives who had begun showing up at his door. Independently of each other, the Sigrund and Connor families had hired eyes to search for their missing daughters. Although at first these inquiries troubled Holmes, he realized quickly that neither family believed he had anything to do with the disappearances. The detectives made no mention of suspecting foul play. They wanted information, the names of friends, forwarding addresses, suggestions on where to look next. He was, of course, happy to oblige. Holmes told his visitors how much it grieved him, truly, deeply grieved him, that he was unable to provide any new information to ease the worry of the parents. If he heard from the women, he of course would notify the detectives at once. Upon parting, he shook each detective's hand and told him that if his work should happen to bring him back to Englewood any time in the future, by all means, stop in. Holmes and the detectives parted as cheerily as if they had known each other all their lives. At the moment, March 1893, the greatest inconvenience confronting Holmes was his lack of help. He needed a new secretary. There was no shortage of women seeking work, for the fair had drawn legions of them to Chicago. At the nearby normal school, for example, the number of women applying for teaching jobs was said to be many times the usual. Rather, the trick lay in choosing a woman of the correct sensibility. Candidates would need a degree of stenographic and typewriting skill, but what he most looked for and was so very adept at sensing was that alluring amalgam of isolation, weakness, and need. Jack the Ripper had founded in the impoverished horrors of Whitechapel, Holmes saw it in transitional women, fresh, clean young things, free for the first time in history, but unsure of what that freedom meant and of the risks it entailed. What he craved was possession and the power it gave him. What he adored was anticipation. The slow acquisition of love, then life, and finally the secrets within. The ultimate disposition of the material was irrelevant, a recreation. That he happened to have found a way to make disposal both efficient and profitable was simply a testament to his power. In March, fortune brought him the perfect acquisition. Her name was Minnie R. Williams. He had met her several years earlier during a stay in Boston and had considered acquiring her even then, but the distance was too great, the timing awkward. Now she had moved to Chicago. Holmes guessed that he himself might be part of the reason. She would be 25 years old by now. Unlike his usual selections, she was plain, short, and plump, her weight somewhere between 140 and 150. She had a masculine nose, thick dark eyebrows, and virtually no neck. Her expression was bland, her cheeks full. A baby face, as one witness put it. She didn't seem to know a great deal. In Boston, however, Holmes had discovered that she possessed other winning attributes. Born in Mississippi, Minnie Williams and her younger sister Anna were orphaned at an early age and sent to live with different uncles. Anna's new guardian was the Reverend Dr. W.C. Black of Jackson, Mississippi, editor of the Methodist Christian Advocate. Minnie went to Texas, where her guardian uncle was a successful businessman. He treated her well and in 1886 enrolled her at the Boston Academy of Elocution. He died in the midst of her three-year program and bequeathed to her an estate valued at between $50,000 and $100,000, about $1.5 to $3 million in 21st century dollars. Anna, meanwhile, became a schoolteacher. She taught in Midlothian, Texas, at the Midlothian Academy. When Holmes met Minnie, he was traveling on business under the alias Henry Gordon, and found himself invited to a gathering at the home of one of Boston's leading families. Through various inquiries, Holmes learned of Minnie's inheritance, and that it consisted largely of a parcel of property in the heart of Fort Worth, Texas. Holmes extended his Boston stay. Minnie called him Harry. He took her to plays and concerts and bought her flowers and books and sweets. Wooing her was pathetically easy. Each time he told her he had to return to Chicago, she seemed crushed. Delightfully so. Throughout 1889, he traveled regularly to Boston and always swept Minnie into a whirl of shows and dinners, although what he looked forward to most were the days before his departure, when her need flared like fire in a dry forest. After a time, however, he tired of the game. The distance was too great, Minnie's reticence too profound. His visits to Boston became fewer, though he still responded to her letters with the ardor of a lover. Holmes's absence broke Minnie's heart. She had fallen in love. His visits had thrilled her. His departures destroyed her. She was perplexed. He had seemed to be conducting a courtship and even urged her to abandon her studies and run with him to Chicago. But now he was gone, and his letters came only rarely. She gladly would have left Boston under the flag of marriage, but not under the reckless terms he proposed. He would have made an excellent husband. He was affectionate in ways she rarely encountered in men, and was adept at business. She missed his warmth and touch. Soon, there were no letters at all. Upon graduation from the Academy of Elocution, Minnie moved to Denver, where she tried to establish her own theatrical company, and in the process lost $15,000. She still dreamed about Harry Gordon. As her theater company collapsed, she thought of him more and more. She dreamed also of Chicago, a city everyone seemed to be talking about and to which everyone seemed to be moving. Between Harry and the soon-to-begin World's Columbian Exposition, the city became irresistible to her. She moved to Chicago in February 1893 and took a job as a stenographer for a law firm. She wrote to Harry to tell him of her arrival. Harry Gordon called on her almost immediately and greeted her with tears in his eyes. He was so warm and affectionate. It was as if they had never parted. He suggested she come work for him as his personal stenographer. They could see each other every day without having to worry about the interventions of Minnie's landlady, who watched them as if she were Minnie's own mother. The prospect thrilled her. He still said nothing about marriage, but she could tell he loved her. And this was Chicago. Things were different here, less rigid and formal. Everywhere she went, she found women her own age, unescorted, holding jobs, living their own lives. She accepted Harry's offer. He seemed delighted. But he imposed a curious stipulation. Minnie was to refer to him in public as Henry Howard Holmes, an alias, he explained, that he had adopted for business reasons. She was never to call him Gordon, nor act surprised when people referred to him as Dr. Holmes. She could call him Harry at any time, however. She managed his correspondence and kept his books, while he concentrated on getting his building ready for the World's Fair. They dined together in his office, on meals brought in from the restaurant below. Minnie showed a remarkable aptitude for the work, Holmes wrote in his memoir. During the first weeks, she boarded at a distance, but later, from about the 1st of March until the 15th of May, 1893, she occupied rooms in the same building and adjoining my offices. Harry touched her and caressed her and let his eyes fill with tears of adoration. At last, he asked her to marry him. She felt very lucky. Her Harry was so handsome and dynamic. She knew that once married, they would share a wonderful life full of travel and fine possessions. She wrote of her hopes to her sister, Anna. In recent years, the sisters had become very close, overcoming an earlier estrangement. They wrote to each other often. Minnie filled her letters with news of her fast intensifying romance and expressed wonder that such a handsome man had chosen her to be his wife. Anna was skeptical. The romance was advancing too quickly and with a degree of intimacy that violated all the intricate rules of courtship. Minnie was sweet, Anna knew, but certainly no beauty. If Harry Gordon was such a paragon of looks and enterprise, why had he selected her? In mid-March, Holmes received a letter from Peter Sigrund, Emmeline's father, asking yet again for help in finding his daughter. The letter was dated March 16th. Holmes responded promptly on March 18th with a typed letter in which he told Sigrund that Emmeline had left his employ on December 1st, 1892. It is possible that Minnie, in her role as Holmes's personal secretary, did the typing. "I received her wedding cards about December 10th, he wrote. She called at the office about 10 days later for her mail after her return from Michigan, where she was married, and again about January 1st, at which point she was disappointed at not finding any mail here for her, and my impression is that she spoke of having written to you previous to that time. Before going away in December, she told me personally that the intention was that she and her husband should go to England on business with which he was connected. But when she called here the last time, she spoke as though the trip had been given up. Please let me know within a few days if you did not hear from her, and give me her uncle's address here in the city, and I will see him personally and ask if she has been there, as I know she was in the habit of calling upon him quite often. He added a postscript in ink. Have you written her Lafayette friends, asking them if they have heard from her? If not, I should think it well to do so. Let me hear from you at all events. Holmes promised Minnie a voyage to Europe, art lessons, a fine home, and, of course, children. He adored children. But first, there were certain financial matters that required their mutual attention. Assuring her that he had come up with a plan from which only great profit would result, Holmes persuaded her to transfer the deed to her Fort Worth land to a man named Alexander.